A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. The big day has arrived, ladies and gentlemen. Despite the distractions of the impending coronavirus lockdown, it is time to elect the 46th president of the United States of America, also known as the leader of the free world. That's right. Despite what you will hear on most media outlets, despite the propaganda pumped out from Brussels, and despite whatever you may think of the influence of China in this world, America is still our greatest ally and the most important country on the global stage. And we should all wish that it does not fall into the wrong hands. I think you know what I'm talking about. We're talking about the people wrecking the inner cities of the United States of America, all of which are run by Democrats. Tonight, I will be bringing you live coverage from the USA in a special presidential election edition of the Independent Republic. You won't want to miss any of it. We'll go through the night with a host of incredible guests from both sides of the Atlantic. It kicks off at 1 o'clock in the morning, goes all the way through until 5, by which time we should have a pretty good idea of what is going on. I will, of course, bring you my predictions as we go through this show. We'll mention to you all the guests that we are going to have coming up a little bit later on, but we of course want to hear from you as well, as ever. 0344 499 1000. Coming up this morning, we are joined by John Redwood MP, former Secretary of State for Wales, who's calling for a more transparent approach from this government on statistics, figures and data in general. I think I couldn't agree more with Mr. Redwood, because quite frankly, we are being treated as if we are complete and utter fools, idiots, people who have no clue about what is actually going on. The Daily Mail today has a fantastic expose of Messrs. Whitty and Valance and the data they chose to show, as opposed to the data they could have shown us in order to justify this second lockdown. Yesterday, we heard from a lot of angry people who can't believe we're having to do it all over again. And now we want to hear from more of you today. And we also want to hear reasons why some of you are happy to lock down again, because apparently that's what the polls are telling us. Apparently, 70% of people would like to see the lockdown happen, and some would like it to be even more severe. 0344 499 1000. Later on, we're joined by Conservative commentator Esther Krakow with her take on the US election and much else besides. Plus, Chef Cyrus Tony Waller from Saturday Kitchen joins us with his views on the hospitality shutdown and how it will affect the restaurant business. And we'll also hear from the Henry Jackson Society on the latest terrorist atrocity in Vienna, a ghastly act committed by ghastly people in another one of Europe's great cities. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, as I was telling you earlier on, the Daily Mail today has got a brilliant expose, and it says this: we call the boffins bluff. And it says how Number 10's experts shamelessly manipulated data and drew biased conclusions to terrify England into locking down. Now, I've been going on about this for a while, and I'm really quite surprised at the way that the government are treating us and the way that the government are using statistics in order to frighten people and into being convinced that the lockdown is necessary. necessary. John Redwood tweeted this yesterday. Why won't the government advisers and NHS management give us believable forecasts rather than hugely wide and some wild illustrations of worst cases? Where are the accurate figures for NHS bed occupancy, and how do they now define a COVID-19 death? And I think that pretty much sums up what I feel about it as well. So, John, a very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I saw your tweet yesterday and I thought that's exactly what I've been saying for quite a long time. I have not been convinced at all that the facts we are being given and the data that we are being sort of presented with and the projections that we're seeing are in any way entirely honest.
Well, I've been calling for the last 6 months for better data and more sensible forecasts, because it started quite early on in the pandemic. We had, I think, four different changes in the definition of a death, and there was a period when it seemed that anyone who had a sniffle or a cough was put down as dying with COVID-19, even if they were dying of something completely different. And then we saw some very wild forecasts, certainly in the early days, about how many cases there would be, which, pleased to say, haven't turned out to be true. And we now see these extraordinary forecasts. I mean, the latest one is this 4,000 daily deaths, which would be terrifying. But we now learn that it was out-of-date data at the time it was put forward.
Right.
It was always a very, very high and unlikely forecast.
Exactly right. And we're seeing, for example, in Liverpool, news today that there's going to be mass testing tried out there to see whether it actually makes a bit of a difference. And as much as, you know, you might hope that it would make a bit of a difference, I don't hold out an awful amount of optimism for it, because we've been told this many times before. But also what we're not told is that the rate of infection appears to be dropping in Liverpool.
Yes, and that's good news. And in my own area, I see that the last week we had fewer cases rather than more cases, and we already had a pretty low level by national standards. So that is an argument for having more locally differentiated responses. Mm. But what this comes down to, Mike, is the conduct of every one of us.
Yeah.
And the government has to offer leadership and guidance. I don't think it can achieve it all by law and rules. We don't have enough police to enforce all these laws, and law is a very blunt instrument.
Yeah.
People have different family circumstances and different employment circumstances, and we just want as many people as possible to make sensitive judgments so that they don't put their neighbours at great risk. And most people do that already, some people don't.
Mm.
It's a question of persuasion. I don't think there are a perfect set of laws which are going to stop the virus.
No, exactly. And I mean, I've just come back from a few days in the Isle of Wight, where for half term, where they've had hardly any infections at all, but they're having to shut everything down. Similarly, in places in parts of southeast England, where there's barely any infection at all, everything gets shut down again. And, you know, there is a great deal of collateral damage potentially here, isn't there?
Well, of course there is. I mean, in the first phase of the pandemic, we lost practically all our non-COVID healthcare, so that lots of people didn't get the treatments they needed, and that may have meant worse situations or the more even deaths that were avoidable. There's the question of suicide and mental stress from all this. But, you know, the aim must be to keep as many livelihoods going as possible, whilst, of course, offering good guidance and sensible rules to try and reduce the spread of the thing so that we can cope with it.
It seems to me as well, Sir John, that there isn't exactly anyone in Cabinet. I mean, I was talking to some people who are familiar with these things, shall we say, who said there's not enough rebels inside the Cabinet right now who are pressing Boris Johnson. Clearly, Rishi Sunak has been a force for good in terms of wanting to keep businesses afloat, extending the furlough scheme and all of that. But there doesn't seem to be enough people, in my mind, saying things to him like, surely saving lives in one area in order to destroy them in another is really a rather unbalanced view of the world, isn't it?
Well, I think there does need to be strong debates in Cabinet, and I think there needs to be a better understanding generally that there is no such thing as the science. So I think when they started these policies, they were hoping that the scientists would have unified good advice and they could follow that and we'd get through it. And it hasn't worked out like that. And it can't work out like that, because this is a relatively new disease. We've got many talented doctors and scientists who are researching it like mad, and they're gradually getting a better understanding. But they disagree amongst themselves, and it's healthy they do, because this is new and they don't have all the right answers yet. And politicians have to make judgments that don't just take into account the conflicting scientific advice, but also the economic impact, the impact on livelihood. Mm. So I'm afraid, yes, the politician has an extremely difficult job, and there isn't an easy answer to just back one or two scientists who happen to have the ear of the government.
No, I think, and that's absolutely right, and I think most responsible individuals and citizens of this country have a great deal of sympathy with the Prime Minister and Boris Johnson's difficult choices. However, yeah, what we don't want to be the subject of is misleading information. I mean, looking at this, the Mail situation today, I don't know whether you've seen it on pages 16 and 17 today, you know, that heat map that they showed, where yeah, the ones that they looked at were all getting darker and darker and darker, and it was all looking terribly, yep, terribly awful. At least half of that graph are light yellow boxes, which show hospitals with zero COVID patients, but they didn't show us that.
No, I know. And I've been asking for proper unified data on hospital capacity and use of hospital capacity for some time. And it's very difficult to get it. And I think that should be the most relevant set of statistics, because their main worry, the scientific advisors of the government, seems to be NHS being overwhelmed. So surely the relevant facts we should have all the time are occupancy of beds, capacity, flexible capacity. Because I thought we'd solve the capacity problem in the first phase of the virus with this very successful, huge construction effort and extra recruitment of staff, so that we would have Nightingale hospitals. And I think they should be the specialist CV19 hospitals, because you don't really want CV19 patients in normal hospitals if you can avoid it, because of cross-infection risk.
That's right. And we hear all the time from medics that, you know, they have less capacity because they have to distance people more and they have to use different wards. But again, looking at the actual COVID statistics, once again in the Daily Mail, Liverpool University Hospital's beds occupied by COVID patients out of a total of 1,595 is 450, so less than a third. Similarly, yep, Sheffield Teaching Hospital's 249 out of 1,442. You know, every single one of these hospitals, which is in crisis, supposedly, has a very limited and smallish number of COVID beds occupied. So I don't know what they're saying and why they're saying it.
Well, that's why we need more explanation. I think they're right that when you get to 30, 40% of COVID patients in your hospital, it obviously restricts very much what you can do for all the other treatments you should be doing, which is why I think they need to look again at using the new capacity and demarking some whole hospitals or chunks of hospital as CV19 places and having really good infection control there, keeping it well away from everybody else in all the general hospital wards, because that I think would help.
Right.
There's no doubt about it that infection spread within hospitals and care homes in the first phase, and we want to try and stop that. Mm.
Now, Michael Gove appeared on television on Sunday and intimated that it may be that the lockdown goes beyond December the 2nd. Boris Johnson today says that's not going to happen, that they are going to come out of it on December the 2nd. But you've expressed some concern about exactly how that works and how we come out of it.
Yes, they need an exit strategy, and we need to be reassured that the model isn't just to have lockdown, get the disease down a bit, relax, and then have another lockdown on a rolling basis. That doesn't really help anybody. I think both Mr. Gove and the Prime Minister are saying the same thing at the moment. I think what they're hoping to do is, at the beginning of December, go back to the regional differentiated lockdowns. I don't think anybody in government is saying we're going to suddenly remove all the controls and lead normal lives again. But I'm not even sure that they can guarantee that transition, because presumably it must be data-driven. And that's, again, brings us back to our opening statement that we need honest, accurate, up-to-date data, and we need more information from them about what levels of whatever they're monitoring is alarming and what levels are acceptable. Mm,
indeed. And how useful do you think it will be for backbenchers like yourself to continue to pressurise the Prime Minister on this particular subject? Because clearly there's a vote tomorrow in the House on these measures, which he's expected to win. I don't imagine there's any other outcome, really. But are you able to influence that?
The opposition, you know, the opposition and all the payroll vote are going to carry this, so there's no way we can threaten to defeat it or whatever.
There's no chance they'll abstain in Labour?
And what we're trying to do is to get a change of thinking and change of policy, and above all, to help the Prime Minister get across a credible story, because his advisors haven't really given him that credible story he needs. He needs, because he's very good at this, to get across a credible story to the public about the choices he's made and carry us all with him, because we desperately need 67 million people to buy into this, because it's the actions of all of us which determine how much social contact there is and how much spread there might be.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you've got his ear, or at any point you do get his ear, it might be worth telling him that from our perspective here at Talk Radio, an awful lot of our listeners are very disillusioned with the man that they voted in to be Prime Minister. They're very disillusioned with the policies on COVID. They're very disillusioned that we're having another lockdown. And many of them have lost faith altogether.
Well, there are people like that. And then, as you said earlier, 70% of the public in opinion polls say that they're very happy to have, well, not happy,
yeah,
but
I don't believe
they
that.
Accept the need for a lockdown. But it's my duty and the duty of other MPs to cross-examine in Parliament and elsewhere these ministers to make sure they thought it all through and that they are, in turn, asking the right questions of these advisers. Because as we've seen, we've had some pretty shoddy data and some very strange graphs recently.
Yes, I think that's right. And somehow that needs to be transmitted and communicated to the Prime Minister that, you know, you can't treat the people of this country like this, because unfortunately for him, social media is now a thing and people can get to see the graphs and people can exchange pieces of information from government websites. I mean, even only yesterday I was on the ONS website looking at the death rates from COVID-19, and it's 6% of all deaths that are happening currently in the country. So, you know, people are asking the same questions. Why are we taking a sledgehammer here to crack a nut?
Well, indeed. And the overall death rate is mercifully very low around the world. I mean, it's over a million deaths worldwide, but that's a small proportion of the total number of deaths that occur. It's still a very serious and unpleasant disease for an unlucky minority who get the bad version of it. And I'm all in favour of doing everything we can to stop its spread and to, above all, find better ways of treating it. And I think the breakthroughs are gradually coming on treatment, which may be the best way out. And there was a good UK breakthrough with the development of steroid treatment, which seems to have saved lives and reduced the intensity of some of these cases. And I'm hoping that more trials of the other proposals, the antibodies and the antivirals, will lead on to more drugs which abate the seriousness for people.
All right. And what do you make of this testing plan for Liverpool? Because the difficulty I think most people, again, will have with the testing plans that have been put in place before is, you know, testing is all very well, but it needs to be alongside lots of other things. You know, if people get told they're going to have to stay off work for 2 weeks, they may not wish to get tested, so they may be more reluctant to do so. Equally, if a test says that you're positive but you have no symptoms, are you going to be convinced enough to take 2 weeks off work in order to safeguard the rest of the community? You know, there are so many different bits to it that, you know, it's another one of these silver bullet policies which we're told will make a change to everything, but it may or may not.
No, I agree with that. I think for it to work, you need at least two very important conditions. The first is you need to persuade the public to cooperate. They have to believe that this is the answer, because unless enough people cooperate, then it won't work. And then secondly, you need to have in place a package of measures for people who would find it very difficult for family and livelihood reasons to self-isolate for 7 days or 14 days. I think you've got to give them financial and other support.
Right, absolutely right. And so, Sir John, I mean, over the course of the next 24 hours, what are you able to do to keep the pressure on the government?
Well, talk to people, as I'm talking to lots of people through your show this morning.
Yeah.
But in Westminster, obviously, I and other MPs are talking to ministers and making these points, which we put out there publicly.
I mean, is there any chance, for example, Duncan Bannatyne this morning was on Julie Hartley Brewer's show saying, can we please keep gyms open? And under Tier 3 in Liverpool, they were locked down first and then opened again. Lancashire was able to keep gyms open. I mean, is there any chance that we could slightly tweak Boris Johnson's lockdown and get him to kind of, you know, give a little back?
Well, we're trying to do that as well. I mean, I think most MPs are making exactly those points, because we've all got hundreds of emails from people saying, what about my gym? What about my outdoor tennis? What about my swim? All those kind of things. And generally, you would have thought that exercise is a good thing to keep us healthy. But clearly, it has to be done with social distancing, and playing around golf with one person out in the open air seems to me to be fine. But
propping up the bar in the golf club afterwards probably isn't such a good idea. So I think, you know, there needs
depends to be... how badly you've played, I suppose.
Yeah, there needs to be common sense about all this. And yes, we would like to see, if we're going ahead, as we presumably are with a England national lockdown, we'd like some of the rough edges made off and some of the things that aren't that harmful to still be allowed.
Indeed. John, thank you very much indeed. Sir John Redwood, Conservative MP for Woking, former Secretary of State for Wales, of course, as well.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
One of the things that we must talk about now, and we're going to talk about it with Dr. Anna Mendoza from Henry Jackson Society, is the terrible attack that happened last night in Vienna. Around about 8 o'clock at night it started, and there's some chilling audio, which I'm not going to play you, actually, because it's quite upsetting, of how guns are being fired, automatic rifles are going off, and you can hear people screaming, you can hear repeated shots being fired. It really is pretty awful. Let's find out from Dr. Alan Mendoza what he's hearing from that part of the world. Alan, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for coming on. Shocking attack, it would seem, but sort of coming on the heels of what's been going on in France over the course of the last week or two, and also another attack on the French embassy in Saudi Arabia. There's clearly something going on here, isn't there?
Yes, I mean, I think we are seeing a resumption of a threat that never went away, really, Mike, but just went quiet for a bit. So that was, of course, the radical Islam terrorist threat. And as you've seen, a number of different incidents in the last week or two. And the reality is that our security services have constantly warned us about the nature of this threat. They've told us it remains, in many countries, the largest threat, although there is also a threat from other sources as well. And unfortunately, the bomber or the attacker only has to get through once, as sadly we've seen again last night.
Well, of course. The worry, though, seems to me to be that there's a lot of links to people arriving in Europe relatively recently from perhaps Tunisia, from parts of North Africa, coming into Europe for this specific purpose. And I think that's what most people are more concerned about.
Yeah, I think obviously you've got questions about how migration policy is working, how borders are being protected, why people are being let in who, you know, shouldn't be here. They're not, you know, sort of here for political asylum purposes. They're here, you know, on the surface, it would appear for economic migration reasons, but they turn out to also be terrorists. So there is a huge concern, as you've just highlighted, about what is going on with Europe's borders and who is being allowed in and what they are doing once they come in, of course, as well, and how monitoring is not working.
Well, that's right, because not least of our concerns is the numbers of people who have come to this country over the course of this year. We think estimates are ranging from sort of 5,000 to 6,000 alone, just coming on dinghies across the channel. It may well be that the huge bulk of those people are entirely peace-loving and want to just start a new life in a place which is safe from them dying. However, you can't discount the fact that some of them might be similar to these people in Vienna.
Yes, and the worst part about this, of course, is that we don't really know who is coming in. You know, when you get boatloads of people coming in trying to sneak in, you don't undergo the rigorous checks you would normally do in a migration process as to working out who the migrants are. And given that we already know we have a security services problem in terms of monitoring extremism in this country, any extra importation of extremism is going to stretch our forces even further.
Yes, exactly right. And as far as this particular attack is concerned, Alan, what do we know so far? Because it's very patchy in terms of the facts coming out of Vienna. You know, at one point last night, there was a thought that there were some hostages being held. It's not that clear whether the gunmen were in that street because they wanted to attack the synagogue, which was closed. It's not that clear whether all of them have, in fact, been apprehended.
Yes, it's very hazy. And even today, even this morning, although the Austrian authorities have been confident, of course, to say this was an Islamist terrorist attack, and they've been able to sadly identify that three people have lost their lives and that an attacker and many others have been injured, attacker has been killed. But it appears there are others still on the loose from what they are saying. And so we don't have a clear view yet of what the specific motivation was. We know it was ISIS related from what the Austrians have told us. We don't know whether this was planned a long time ago advance whether it was a cell, how this operated. And I think those facts are going to take some time to come out, given the patchy information we've received thus far, which indicates the authorities aren't quite certain themselves of what yet is going on.
No, it's very, very worrying. And as far as the Austrian sort of situation overall is concerned, I mean, they haven't really had too much problem with this in recent memory, have they?
Well, as with all countries, Austria has, in Europe, Austria has had extremism issues. It's true they haven't had a, you know, kind of a mass atrocity like this, the sort of assault that at one stage looked like it could have been like a Bataclan or a Mumbai-style assault on their streets. But, you know, there have been numerous warnings by their security services about far-right extremism, by radical Muslim extremism. And the sad truth is, in today's Europe, none of us, it appears, are immune from this curse.
No, indeed. And as somebody pointed out last night on Twitter, how awful is it that Jewish people are being told to hide inside their homes in the centre of Vienna?
Well, it's all very reminiscent of the 1930s in terms of, you know, being a Jew on continental Europe once again. If you're forced to hide your identity, what does that say about us as free societies? What does that say about us as liberal democracies that we cannot protect people? It's a terrible stain on our own democracy and public service. And people have been going on in recent weeks about, say, the threat to democracy from people like Donald Trump. We've got our own problems here in Europe, and it's not Donald Trump causing them. It is our failure to combat extremism within our societies.
Quite. And one of the things that people always raise about mainland Europe is it's much easier to get hold of guns there because an awful lot of military sort of hardware came across Europe from the Eastern Bloc and also continued to come through the Balkans War and all that kind of thing. I presume it's still relatively easy to move weapons through borders which are not really checked. Whereas in this country, hopefully, there's less chance of that.
Mike, thank God we're an island. Let's put it that way, because as you've just identified, the ways to get into the UK and the ways to bring arms into the UK are far more limited than you have in continental Europe. And you're quite correct to state that the arms trade stemmed from the fall of the Soviet Union beyond the Balkan Wars. It is much easier to get weapons across, A, because the land borders are more porous, B, because in many cases, until fairly recently, there haven't been checks because of the Schengen zone. So you can transport weapons back and forth quite easily. And thankfully, we don't have that problem, in the sense that as an island we are able to police our borders and you just can't bring a gun in just like that.
I mean, unusually, I think I'm right in saying, nobody's actually claimed this yet, have they? We haven't heard from any organisation saying that they did it. Is that unusual?
It is unusual, but it probably reflects, frankly, firstly, that ISIS is in a much weakened form from what it was. I mean, it's been essentially defeated on land. Its leadership structure has been, turned over. This assailant appears to have been an ISIS sympathizer from what we're hearing from the Austrians, but it's true they haven't claimed it formally. And I suspect that reflects either that it was handled locally, it came out of the blue, or that ISIS just is not organized enough to sort of do the sorts of things they were doing even as little as 2 years ago.
Yeah. I'm reading the latest reports here that the gunman who killed 4 and wounded 17 was apparently released early from prison on terror charges because he was too young to be kept in jail. 20-year-old Kuchtim Fedzulay was jailed in April 2019 because he wanted to travel to Syria. So the suggestion, I suppose, being that he was an Austrian citizen.
Yes, that's an interesting point, if that's the case, and indeed his youth allowing him to sort of leave prison early.
Yeah.
But then again, we've got the next question we have to ask is why was he not being monitored? If he was nonetheless a danger, he may not have been able to be kept in prison. What was going on in terms of Austrian intelligence monitoring? Have they dropped the ball here?
Well, this is, again, the same sort of question that's always raised, that there's only so much monitoring they can really do. And if you've got so many suspects who are being released out onto the streets, it's very difficult. You know, maybe it'd be a better idea not to release them.
Well, that's why, of course, we had a campaign here, as you know, to end automatic release so early and halfway in sentences for people guilty of the most serious crimes like terrorism. And as a result, we've increased the limits here to 2/3 of their sentence at least. And I think other countries are going to have to look very carefully and make the assessment that terrorism is not like other crimes. It's an ideological crime. It's not conducted out of a moment of anger. It's planned. There is a reason why people are doing it. And in many cases, sadly, they are not de-radicalised in prison and come out believing the same or worse at the other end.
No, quite right. Dr. Alan Mendoza, thank you very much indeed. Executive Director of the Henry Jackson Society on the terrible attack that was made in Vienna last night. It turns out that the boy, he's not really a boy, he's a young man who did most of the shooting. shooting is aged 20, killed 4 people, wounded 17. It's not clear how many other people were involved. He was wearing a dummy explosive belt. He seems to have been shot dead now. But there's a big manhunt going on for at least one other attacker who might be on the run. And this guy apparently originated from Albania, which is one of the countries which, of course, does export an awful lot of people through asylum seeking programs to all sorts of countries in Europe. And these are the kinds of issues that will have to be tackled by any government, regardless of what's going on under lockdown. It seems to me that there has been something going on in Europe, in France, and now in Austria over the past few weeks, which is a very, very dangerous development indeed. And here we are in the UK, not knowing really whether we're going to be next. And that is the problem, surely.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham, Talk Radio.
Now, before we speak to Esther Krakow, let's have a listen to some of the closing speeches from the last day of campaigning. Of course, Donald Trump was going absolutely all over the country, covering thousands and thousands of miles, talking to thousands and thousands of people. His last rally was in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
If you want your children to be safe, if you want your values to be honored, if you want your life to be treated with dignity and respect, then I am asking you to go to the poll tomorrow and vote, vote, vote. Remember what I said 4 years ago. I am your voice, and we will make America great again, and that's what we're doing.
And that, of course, has been the Trump mission. That has been the Trump message, that we will make America great again. He has been relentless in the last few days. I don't know whether he's not sleeping or whether he's got some kind of special energy that he seems to have found. Nigel Farage, who we spoke to yesterday, said he's never seen anything like it. Let's hear from Joe Biden. His last rally was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Well, let me tell you something, folks. Tomorrow's the beginning of a new day. Tomorrow, we can put an end to a presidency that has left hardworking Americans out in the cold. Tomorrow, we can put an end to a presidency that has divided this nation and fanned the flames of hate. Tomorrow, we can put an end to a presidency that has failed to protect this nation.
Joe Biden there speaking at his last rally in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, of course, will be a massive battleground because it's been said that if Joe Biden cannot win Pennsylvania, then he cannot win the White House. Esther Krakow is here with us. Esther, very good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
So we've reached the day, finally, after all of the most bizarre kind of, you know, corona-type campaigning that we've seen, where people are wearing masks all over the place.
Yeah,
you know, they're standing
even outside.
Standing on stages outside in the freezing cold, you know, unable to get very many people. I mean, Trump has managed to get thousands of people, though, around him, and he's been accused of being careless for doing
Did
that.
Did you see that picture of, like, I think it was like 70,000 people at this rally in Pennsylvania?
I know. And Pennsylvania is a big deal for him and for Biden. Because, of course, Biden came out at one of the I think it was the second debate, and basically said, denied that he was going to do away with fracking and denied that he wanted to do away with fossil fuels. And then everybody dug up this interview that he'd done and loads of other interviews in which he said, I want to do away with fossil fuels and fracking, which is a big deal in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I would be, I must admit, I'll be very shocked if Joe Biden wins Pennsylvania. I think.
Well, if he doesn't win it, then he ain't winning the White House, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be very shocked if he wins in general, but Pennsylvania would be a huge deal if he did win it. I'd be very, very shocked, just because, you know, forget the fact that he says he doesn't want to ban fracking. It's the indecisiveness. Yeah. Obviously, you know, these videos have cropped up. And then Kamala Harris, who's definitely, you know, anti-fracking.
Yeah.
So it's not even a ticket that you could, I suppose, reasonably place a bet on if you're living in that state.
It was interesting, actually. I was listening to James Whale's show last night, and he had a call from a woman originally from Sevenoaks, but who is a dual citizen in the United States and has lived in San Francisco for the best part of the last 20 odd years, and she's a firefighter, right?
Yeah.
And she was saying how dreadful it is in some of these Democrat cities now, like San Francisco, which
like
are
LA.
So badly run, like LA. Friend of mine as well, who lives in LA, has moved to Arizona for the prevailing period, because there's a lot of people who think that there might be a massive kind of violent upsurge from people who are not Trump supporters if he wins.
Yeah. You know, I was saying to a friend, it'd be really funny if Trump won California.
Yeah, I mean, that's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. But, there's a psyche that I don't understand in those areas. A lot of people are fleeing California.
Yeah.
And they end up voting for the same horrible politicians that made their states unlivable in the first place. Yeah. I don't understand that.
I know, it's strange, isn't it? But I think the trouble as well is that it's an interesting race for the first time for me as well, because an awful lot of Democrats are not comfortable with what the Democrat Party has become.
Yeah.
Some Republicans are not happy with Donald Trump as the leader of the Republican Party either. So there's a kind of a mismatch going on. And yet we're told there's going to be a bigger voter turnout for this election than the last one.
And I think that means that this vote is more symbolic than, you know, other votes in the past. I think for me, what I've noticed with the Democrat Party is the moderates in the Democrat Party have just fallen through the floor.
Yeah.
That moderate section of the Democrat Party, which is really their bread and butter. I mean, that's how Obama won in 2008 and 2012.
Yeah.
They have literally just fallen through the floor. And, you know, I think it's been such a mistake for Biden, but Kamala as well, to embrace the very far left part of the party in the way that they've done and made it very vocal. Look at the squad.
Mm.
Look at people like Bernie Sanders. Look at how far Bernie Sanders came.
Right.
They have literally effectively rejected their main base and have shifted so far left that the reason why I think there's such a huge voter turnout is because there's something fundamentally wrong with one of the big main parties in the US.
Do you think there's some similarities you could draw between what's happened to them and what's happened to the Labour Party as
well? Oh, yeah, with the Momentum Group.
Yeah, because Labour are now trying to kind of pull back from that, having suspended Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, I have to say, I was very slightly irritated to find myself on holiday on the week that Jeremy Corbyn got suspended from the Labour Party and the same week that Keir Starmer ran over a cyclist.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is that they have both similarly moved to this kind of intellectual left position without taking any of their traditional working class voters with them.
Yeah, and it's very weird. I don't know where that strategy came from. And you notice a lot of people that tend to, I suppose, have shifted the parties as far left as they have. They tend to be sort of middle class, you know, elite educated, university educated, you know, individuals who, you know, sometimes question the agenda.
Right.
And for me, that's just a result of the university system, because there's no other reason behind it. These are people that clearly have very little life experience, or, you know, have lived in a bubble of sort of academia their entire lives. And they have the people that have managed to shift these parties left. And I think, you know, we're going to see the same thing happen that happened, you know, last year at the general election.
Sure.
We're going to see the same thing in the US.
And what they're trying to do, the Democrats, of course, and this is why we're told that there's a massive kind of postal vote and the early voting has been going on in many of the states in the South, is they're trying to galvanize the black vote.
Yeah.
They're trying to galvanize the ethnic vote and the young vote. But that may not matter if, in fact, Donald Trump wins New York back, if he wins Florida, if he wins Pennsylvania, if he wins Ohio. You know, none of
that will
make any difference.
I doubt he'll win New York. But I think one thing the Democrats, unfortunately for them, I think all of it's come in this particular general election, in the sense that there's also a huge anti-Democrat movement in the US now. You know, minorities are saying, actually, you need a little bit more. It's not enough to just rely on the black and Latino voters saying, oh, you know, the other guys are really racist, because it's like, well, you haven't done much either.
Right.
So are you the real racist?
Yeah.
And I think they're really underestimating that.
Yes, I think so. So, I mean, as far as the sort of the way that things are going to pan out later on, obviously, we're going to be on the air throughout the night. We're expecting there to be some early indications by maybe 2-3 o'clock in the morning, with a bit of luck, if we can do that. But there's also an awful large portion of the sort of commentariat who think this is going to turn into a very long and very drawn out legal battle, because Trump is going to declare victory because he's voted, you know, because all the postal votes may not have been counted, and then the postal votes may sway a different way.
I'm very skeptical of that. I'm going to turn off my social media by like 10 p.m. this evening. I don't want to know anything.
Well, don't forget to watch the show.
I mean, yeah, no, Mike, I will not. I will literally be in a hole on the ground. Yeah. No, I don't really want to be in the thick of it. I'm not very good with suspense and drama in that way.
Okay.
I think because there's going to be such a historic turnout, I don't think, you know, the waiting for the mail-in ballots would have that much of an influence. I'm very, very skeptical of that, but
it's going to be interesting. Yeah, I mean, may well be that, you know, you'll wake up in the morning and they'll still be counting and nothing will have happened. I mean, it's a bit like those interminable council elections that we have in this country, where you go, so who won that council? Oh, we'll find out a week on Friday.
And
you're kind of going, well, why does it take so long? And it is, I mean, it's very interesting in America, where they've got this kind of bizarre system, which is actually, you know, quite antiquated compared to what everybody else in the rest of the world does. They had, remember the hanging chads debate when back in Florida, this was probably, I think it was Bush and Gore, when Florida was going both ways. It was declared CBS anchor that Gore had won, and he declared it so early that he had to then cancel that, reverse it, then declared about two other different results. But the phrase that everybody's mind was turned to was this hanging chad, because you go in, you don't actually mark an X in a box, you go in and you pull a lever which kind of punches a hole where you want it to be punched, which can result in all sorts of, you know, problems, because it's a very antiquated way of doing things. And so a lot of people have said, you know, isn't it time that they modernized a little bit more?
Election system.
But the other thing, I suppose, philosophically, that I would ask you about is the dearth of opportunities for younger politicians. You know, there were younger politicians that stood in at the beginning when, you know, Trump and Biden were being nominated during the whole process. Yeah. But, you know, they've ended up with these two guys who, in the end, don't really represent America, but they represent a particular generation, don't they?
And it's really weird. I always say, you know, and I think this is the fault. I mean, you know, Trump is still pretty energetic, but, you know, shifting the focus onto the Democrat Party in the selection of a candidate, I feel like if they'd chosen someone like Tulsi Gabbard or anyone who's kind of a respectable politician in the cleaner phrase of the term, would have beaten Trump, like, hands down. I don't know how, of 330 million people, of a party as powerful and as large as the Democrat Party, you chose someone who can't even get his words out. Like, well, his mental faculties are in question.
That little speech we had him make there in Pittsburgh, he's already sort of, you know, mumbling his words and kind of, you know, slightly slurring them. He came out with something the other day which Nigel Farage retweeted, which was basically
gibberish.
Just gibberish. Yeah. You know, nobody could tell what he was saying. I mean, I don't think there's many people who believe that if he does win, that he will take his presidency to the full term.
If he does win, it's Kamala Harris who's going to be the next president. Right. And, you know, that's something that nobody else voted for. And a funny thing about Kamala is, again, she is like, I don't understand why the Democratic Party did this. I mean, I know they were trying to curry the favor of the black vote with Kamala as, you know, being on the ticket. But it's like, this is a woman that's made a career of imprisoning young black men for minor offenses.
Yeah.
And she's Indian. She's not even I don't even understand the cognitive dissonance of the Democratic Party with regard to this woman.
Right.
This woman, A, is, okay, racially ambiguous. We can put it that way. She's not black. And she's made a career out of, you know, jailing young black men in the US. Mm. How exactly are you supposed to curry favor with anyone with a candidate like
that? But then that's the whole problem, is it not, with the Black Lives Matter movement, that it's not clear who they represent exactly, because there's an awful lot of people who have been involved in some of the rioting in America who are white and middle-class kids who have decided to join in the sort of burning and looting of shops.
Yeah, which they say is justified.
To make a political point about a group of people that they are not part of, which seems very odd to me in the beginning. I mean, we saw, I think, last week that Black Lives Matter has now officially applied to become
a political party,
which I think is an interesting move, because it will make them far less able to demonstrate. It will make them far less able to be representative on even the media, because they now will be treated as a political organisation, which up until now that hasn't been the case.
And that's what everyone was saying. We were all saying this is not a wholesome anti-racist movement. This movement is political.
Right.
And, you know, even in schools, people were just, teachers and faculty members were very anxious about talking about it, because on the one hand, you know, especially because the teachers' unions in this country are very left-wing, they're like, this is anti-racism. But on the other hand, they couldn't deny the clear political nature of this organisation.
Right.
And now they've obviously registered as a political party.
Well, it will also prohibit them from accessing various things.
Yeah,
like, they won't be able to be represented, perhaps, you know, like by sports organisations, yeah, because they're a political party. They can't, yeah, get involved in any kind of sporting activity. They can't be sort of endorsed by companies, because companies now would then be in the business of endorsing political parties. So, yeah, they've almost shot themselves in the foot, I think.
Yeah, and this is kind of egg on the face at the Premier League, yeah, for the Premier League, because it's just like, you know, go woke, go broke is a thing, right?
Yeah.
But they jumped on the bandwagon. I'm not even sure if players didn't want to wear the jerseys with Black, yeah, Lives Matter on it. They were allowed not to.
Yes.
And they've made this huge stance supporting this organisation. And now look,
right,
what's happened.
And what do you think will happen in the US if Trump does win another 4 years in terms of those types of movements and that type of kind of demonstration culture that's been growing there? Because, I mean, a lot of people have said that there are many, you know, it's very tense in a lot of American, yeah, cities, that there is a sense that there might be trouble if he does win.
Yeah.
And the police are gearing up for that, and it doesn't sound good. But they can't do that for 4 years, surely, can they?
Well, I mean, the media and celebrities have definitely tried their best to keep up the tantrum. Mm. I haven't actually seen a lot of celebrities saying they'll leave the country this time, so I'm guessing
they realize. Didn't do it last time, did they?
They don't
do what they say.
Yeah, you know. Well, shocking.
And we're still waiting for Yasmin Alibi Brown to leave the country, wouldn't she?
We're waiting for a lot of them. We're, yeah, waiting for about half of Silicon Valley. Anyway.
exactly right.
I think, you know, there are shops that are boarding up, companies are boarding up their shops because they're anticipating. The reality is, a lot of the violence that we do see, whoever wins, will not be from mainly Trump supporters. That's just a fact. It will definitely come from the militant left that we've seen,
right,
you know, taking a foothold in the country.
But I guess my question has it been a fad, or will it become part of kind of what you would call mainstream America? Because America is a country that I know pretty well. You know, my sister still lives there, my mother lives there, my son lives there. But it's not really a country that I recognise anymore in terms of the way that it's performing and behaving.
I don't think it's a fad. I think these people are, you know, when you're ideologically possessed, you do everything that's outside of reason, right? Mm. And these people are here to stay. Obviously, the left have a very strong foothold in the culture in the US. I think, you know, we'll start seeing the influence of these movements dissipate when, I suppose, more center-right or more center organizations and groups and thinkers start to take a bit more control of the media, of culture and stuff like that. And there's just actually a true diversity of opinion. I don't think it's a fad. I think that, you know, either way, whatever happens, there will be some sort of violence, which is very unfortunate. But I do think eventually America will come out stronger.
Yeah, well, let's hope so, Esther. Thank you very much indeed.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, one of the things that did surprise me this morning, and I don't want you to read anything into this in particular, but it just struck me that the Daily Mail this morning doesn't even talk about COVID, doesn't do anything about COVID until page 14. We've been telling you about the incredible graphs that they've been putting out, which pretty much put to shame the government's presentation on Saturday. But they instead dedicate their entire front page to what is quite a remarkable story that you may have heard a little bit about over the last couple of days. Martin Bashir, who is, of course, famously the man who interviewed Princess Diana on Panorama way back in 1995, in which she said, "There are three of us in this marriage." It was that interview, right? It turns out that Martin Bashir, allegedly, according to Princess Diana's brother, Earl Spencer, actually falsely put together a letter accusing Charles of an affair with the boy's nanny. And all sorts of other sort of, you know, sort of dark arts supposedly were used by Bashir in order to get the interview to air. Now, Earl Spencer is involved in a feud now with Tim Davie, the new Director General of the BBC, who has sort of issued some kind of mealy-mouthed apology, piecemeal apology is what Spencer describes it as, about how she was trapped and tricked into giving an interview that she never really wanted to give. Let's talk to Charles Ray, who is, of course, former Royal Editor of The Sun, who remembers that night, I'm sure, as well as I do. Charles, a very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Michael.
Yes, I mean, I was just remembering and telling Marta, my producer, about the night there that I was tasked with night editing the Daily Express that night. And all the senior executives were taking the night off for some bizarre reason. And I remember sort of scrambling from one edition to the next as each you know, revelation came out, starting off with "I will not go quietly" and finishing up with "there were three of us in this marriage." And this is an extraordinary story, isn't it?
It is extraordinary. And I, like you, remember the night vividly. I was sitting in a room listening because we never got advanced copies of what she was going to say or anything. So we were taking it down as she was speaking. And every word that she came out with was, wow, God, yeah. Oh my God. It was And you, everybody was sort of saying, wow, what a lucky sod that Martin Bashir was, managing to persuade the Princess of Wales. It now, this has been rumbling on since 1996. I mean, 96 was when Charles Spencer first raised the issue that, you know, Diana was tricked. And you know, the then BBC Director General, Lord Hall, carried out some sort of inquiry in which he exonerated Martin Bashir, who ironically is the religious affairs correspondent. So you wouldn't expect the religious affairs correspondent to be up to anything naughty. Otherwise, no. The confessional would be quite high. Now, we've got a situation where Charles Spencer is basically accusing Martin Bashir of yellow journalism. And we have to say here that Martin Bashir has not been able to make any comment whatsoever because he's quite ill at the moment with COVID-19. So right. We're still waiting to hear if he's got anything to say about this. But in this, in essence, Charles Spencer says that that a document was produced which showed that two senior royal aides were in the employ of the Secret Service and were being paid by them to spy on the Princess of Wales. And it was these documents that persuaded Charles Spencer to introduce Bashir to the Princess of Wales. It then transpires that he then said to Diana after, look, I don't think you should go ahead with this because I don't think Bashir is telling the truth and everything else. Diana said, yeah, fine. Well, the rest, as we know, is history. She decided herself she was going on. Now, these documents that Bashir seems to have produced relate, in effect, preyed on the insecurities and paranoia of the Princess of Wales at that time. She was convinced that her mobile phone and her other phone, her landline phone, was being bugged by the Secret Service. She also had quite a high-profile row with Tiggy Leg Bourke, in which she uttered the immortal phrase, sorry to hear about the baby, suggesting that she'd had an abortion. Completely false allegation by the princess. And so these were the documents that were produced. Now, the BBC have said that the documents that were not used and were not shown to the Princess of Wales, and they have a letter to this effect from the Princess of Wales that says that she did not see these documents. Unfortunately, they seem to have lost that signed letter from the Princess of Wales. But this is going to run and run, and it's going to be a big battle, literally a battle royal over this allegation. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, the Princess of Wales was determined that she was going to do this interview. And I don't think that this behind-the-scenes massive row would have stopped her, to be perfectly honest.
No, quite. And, I mean, Tim Davie, who's the incoming sort of director-general, has got plenty of things on his plate already. I'm sure he doesn't welcome the addition of this being piled on top of it, because there must be presumably producers around who were involved in that show on Panorama who Martin Bashir may have or may not have brought into his confidence.
That's right, and it is alleged that the certainly one of the documents was fabricated by a BBC a graphic artist. It's an allegation, and we've still got to wait for that to be proved. But it doesn't seem that the BBC are they're fudging the issue on the document. They're not saying it's true, and they're not saying it's not true. And of course, we haven't had the opportunity to hear from Martin Bashir, who I'm sure will have a lot to say on this at some stage.
And what do you think Spencer's sort of motivation for this is? Because obviously, as you would imagine, his nephews, Harry and William, can't be too happy about all this being dug up all over the place again. And Spencer himself famously made that incredible speech at Diana's funeral, which he kind of more or less attacked the press for killing her, blamed the tabloids for hounding her to her death, promised to look after the kids for the rest of their lives, and then really didn't.
Well, no, and we have to also remember that Spencer was the one that when the Princess of Wales pleaded with him to stay at Althorp when things were going through a very, very bad patch, he turned her down and didn't want to step up and help. So, I mean, it's a bit, you know, this thing of him now jumping on this bandwagon again, is it going to change anything? I mean, it's not going to change a thing. She gave the Panorama interview. She knew what she was doing and she did it. Whether or not these documents ever existed and were shown to Spencer, I don't really think it's the point. It's a great story, and we, the media, are reveling in it.
Yes.
But whether it's going to alter anything, it's not. So at the end of the day, if the BBC and Martin Bashir, you know, apologise for it all, I don't see what it's going to do. She still said there were three of us in this marriage, and it was the most amazing interview that anybody has ever seen for a great many years since.
Oh, absolutely right. And of course, you know, she also spoke to a great many other journalists, you included, at various different times. Richard Kay specifically. Yeah. She also, of course, did the whole Andrew Morton book. So it wasn't as if she was kind of that unpersuadable to talk.
No. And we have to remember that by the time she was doing Panorama, you know, the Morton book, Diana, Her True Story, was a number world bestseller. And it was round about that time as well that we discovered, or shortly after, that we discovered that it wasn't just people who were close to Diana who was giving out the information. Mm. It was actually Diana herself in taped messages to Andrew Morton.
Yeah.
So this thing about, you know, his suggestion that she may not have given this interview, I do not believe that. I think she was going to give that interview no matter what.
Yes. So this again goes back to what is it that Spencer wants, really? Because, you know, he's been a guy who's been a bit of a sort of a villain figure for the press for many years, not least because of what he said in Westminster Abbey, but also, you know, he was the NBC royal correspondent at various points, was he not? He then went off to live in South Africa, where all sorts of things happened that led to various different marriages. And so, you know, he's a bit of a hate figure for Fleet Street, isn't he?
Well, he is, yes. I mean, he's got form, as they say. And I'm not sure what it is he wants out of this. I mean, he seems to be saying in his letter to Mr. Davey that their apology is mealy-mouthed and he wants a more substantive apology. Well, I mean, you can only say sorry, you know, once or twice.
Right.
I mean, what else do you need to say? I think he's probably taking advantage of the fact that it's now 25 years since you gave that interview, and this has reared its head again. As I say, this has been simmering for a great many years, and, you know, he's having another pop at it, and
yes. He's
getting the publicity out of it.
Yeah, interesting times. Well, Charles, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Great to see you as well.
Talk Radio across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.